Welcome to the 14th episode of Reverse Sweat Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Toby Chad.
And as rain stops play across the country, this podcast's enthusiasm is undampened.
Yes, here we are, 2 days into the first ever test at the Rose Bowl. Some 50 overs, 60 overs have been bowled, something like that.
And a lot of rain stopped play.
A lot of rain stopped play. A lot of the Crick Info writers and BBC writers having to fill the time with...
And to be fair, you can't really blame the Rose Bowl for the weather. I think it's a lovely venue. I think it's a wonderful venue. I mean, the story so far is one basically of Sri Lankan struggles, isn't it?
It is. But one of the interesting questions is whether what we've seen so far in this test has kind of negated what happened at Lord's. Because at the end of the test in Lord's, we were saying that the English bowling attack was looking one-dimensional without Anderson. It was particularly weak. But they've come out here and they've taken... You know, it's the Sri Lanka 177/9. Do you think we should?
Well, the conditions are obviously huge. The conditions have obviously played a huge role in this. I think the criticism of Lord's was probably overdone. I mean, I think you had Andrew Strauss's very sensible point. England's bowlers aren't robots. They are going to have off days. Interesting that actually it's not Anderson who's been the destroyer in chief on his return. It's really been all about
Tremlett.
I mean, fascinating to know that. I mean, a year ago, Chris Tremlett wasn't really anywhere near the England first 11. And he's now looking increasingly going to his India series as the key man.
But having said all this, there is an argument that it is England are susceptible to bowling particularly well when... He's susceptible to bowling particularly well. Well, they bowl particularly well when the conditions are conducive to it. But at Lord's, where you had a flat track and a good batting lineup playing sensibly and playing well, because the attack was all very much of a muchness and you didn't have the differences between the Tremlett and the Andersons.
Anderson has a guile that the rest of the attack lacks, really, and he has the ability to do something different with the ball.
Well, he has a guile, but he also has, exactly as you say, he's shorter, he can swing it, he can move it a lot more, and he bowls a lot fuller than a lot of the other bowlers.
I apologise if you've just heard me crunch a crisp. I mean, we generally have...
In a particularly subtle way, with one hand half over
Toby,
the microphone.
If Toby came across as distracted then, that was because I had breached the unwritten rule that you don't have a crisp while we're on air. I was just tempted, I apologise.
If
the bowler's reputations took a hit at Lord's, we had one man whose reputation seemed to... I mean, not be reinvented, but in some degree repaired. Is the debate over Kevin Peterson now over?
Well, it's interesting, because this debate has... I think it is mainly a media construction, and it's a media construction because Kevin Peterson is someone who has never tried to, probably couldn't, if he did try to, handle the media in a particularly good way. He doesn't know how to get the media on side, as opposed to Andrew Strauss, who comes across as a nice...
Here's a question. Had he failed at Lord's, had he failed again here, do you think there was a genuine possibility of him being dropped for the India series, or do you think this was so much a media construction that he would have played, even...
Well, do you think, as India captain, you'd want to face England with or without Kevin Peterson?
Well, I think this is the point, isn't it? There's still that perception of him, and I think it's very strong within the England camp.
And actually, he would come in as well. That's the other question. I think at the moment, there isn't necessarily an alternative. I mean, it's not saying that they don't have strength and depth, as they do, but I don't think there's an alternative for
Well, certainly a player who looks superior, perhaps. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting, there does seem to be this need for the media to have a fall guy. And I mean, I think there's been a suggestion that now Strauss, perhaps, with Peterson having got that innings, Strauss is maybe the new target. And it's odd, why do we need to have someone who we're going at? Why do we need to have someone who we're taking?
Because otherwise papers wouldn't have anything to
write
about.
Well, perhaps it's as simple as that. It's the need to fill pages. But for the moment, I mean, I was pleased to see KP play with the commitment he did, the serious way in which he played Harath, carefully at the start of the innings. I mean, he looked like someone who's desperate to make a career.
Well, that's exactly the thing, and he wasn't. In the past, there's always been this thing of, oh, that's the way he plays when he got out by dancing down the wicket to an off-spinner yet again, or playing some kind of rash shot to an off-spinner yet again. But he seemed determined to apply himself and say, this isn't how I play, but this is how I've got to play at the moment in order to play myself back into form.
So away from the test arena, in the domestic arena, it's all been 2020. What's been the most exciting performance for you? You know, where's your attention been drawn to?
Well, my attention has been drawn all over the place simply because there's been been so much going on, and I find it...
It's been chaotic.
It's difficult to follow the whole thing. But I was very... My eye was caught by a match between Somerset and Essex. In fact, the two teams that I follow, in fact, so I have divided loyalties, in which Somerset batted first, and Jess Gothic made a 108, a better than a run and ball 108. And then James Hildreth came in at the end of the innings and scored 64 off just 22 balls. And what was so impressive there is that Somerset were in a pretty strong position. And when Hildreth came in, he could have just sort of cruised to the end and got a solid 40. But he came in and made a strong position into an entirely unassailable one.
And we've talked about Hildreth before as a possible England player, and maybe, you know, he can make a case for his selection within format.
And stamping his name somehow. And actually, there are a lot of... there's a lot of opportunity within 2020 for players to put in good sort of one-off performances.
And, I mean, my attention was drawn really to a young, a very promising young English talent who's unfortunately gained notoriety for all the wrong reasons. Azeem Rafiq was banned for a month, in fact, after an angry Twitter outburst against the England under-19 coach. 2020 seen him back to, well, you know, what he's gained his status for. He's played a fairly decisive hand in the Roses match, took 3 for 15 for Yorkshire, just off 4 overs, and then hit the winning runs, hitting 11 off 4 balls to get Yorkshire over the line. I mean, it's interesting. Rafiq's the kind of player who, as a result of his behaviour, as a result of some pretty indifferent performances in the four-day game, has kind of, his reputation has slipped a little bit, and in the 2020 formats allowed him to kind of make his case again.
And he is very much in the mould, I mean, in several ways, of Samit Patel.
Yeah, Samit Patel.
Who has also been doing quite well across the knots.
Yeah, and I mean, this sort of a role of the spinning all-rounder, I mean, in terms of the team that has impressed me most, Samit Patel and knots, they have made a very promising start to the 2020 campaign. They've just got a very solid-looking side. They've got a couple of very experienced Australians, Adam Vosges and David Hussey, class batsmen with lots of experience, and that makes it very stable.
And it makes it stable, but it also means that there's that, with that course of the team. Because so often, a lot of the criticism of coal-power players, and a lot of the justified criticism of coal-power players, is that teams come to depend on them. But what seems to have happened quite well at Notts is that they don't depend on their Australian batsmen. But what their Australian batsmen do is they provide a backbone which other players can sort of feed off.
And a great example of that is young Alex Hale. I mean, a really exciting English talent. I think he's just 22. Really hard-hitting young opening batsman. And the fact that he can go out there and play with players of the experience in Vosges and Hussey is working very well. A slight oddity of this not side, Darren Pattinson, you know, he of the one
good
test
old,
spring
good
and play, is having a very good time in the 2020 format. 5 for 25 against Warwickshire is having great success. Which team have you seen as the...
Well, just as you were saying with Rafiq, how people have been sort of turned around by 2020, Hampshire, who were having an absolute shocker in the county championship, and had failed, I think, to win a game up to this point in the season, and we're now mid June. They've been looking rather good in the 2020s, and they at the beginning of the campaign made 2 7 wicket wins against Somerset and Surrey, and then have won 3 matches since then, three nail biters. Including
it's interesting
a,
that
a nice
side
five over
can,
match against Kent.
This five over game, very interesting whether that one day might be the future of the format. How low can we go in terms of overs? I mean, it's interesting that a side can fail so much in one format and then be so successful in another. I mean, it does suggest that, you know, we are in an era where specialists can make a difference. I mean, Imran Tahir, someone who gained a lot of attention.
Yeah, he is. And the other person who I was quite surprised about as a 2020 batsman was Neil McKenzie, who I first came across
as a big hitter, really.
Well, in that series against South Africa, which England played in 2004, the drawn series, where McKenzie was one of the most one of the less dashing batsmen in the South African side, but he seems to have invented himself very nicely.
Well, away from what's happened and towards, well, what is going to happen, the next couple of weeks is going to see the test series between India and the West Indies get underway. I mean, in the same way, I suppose, that the England-Sri Lanka series is very much seen as kind of the appetizer, the warm-up. I'm sure India will be seeing this as very much the warm-up for their series against England. Indies are the side that seem to have the big decisions to make. Are we going to see the old guard of Chanderpaul, Gail, Sarwan play, or do you think the decision's going to be taken, they need to move on?
The West Indies board seems slightly incapable of making any kind of decision, really. There's been this question hanging around for a while now, hasn't it, about the part that that big three are going to be playing.
Particularly Gail, the controversy seems to be constant.
Particularly Gail, who doesn't really help his case.
And has a very exciting new haircut, which if you haven't seen,
it's well worth a Google.
He seems to be, I'll show that to you. So he does actually have some hair. He has some hair, and he appears to have too much time on his hands.
Well, frankly, they better play him then, haven't they?
Purely
if his hairstyles are getting out of control. Out of control, exactly. Half of me says that the West Indies need to move on. The other half says that if you rip out the three of the best players, certainly Chanderpaul and Sarwan are the two, probably indisputably the two best players in the side, that actually you've got nothing to grow from, you've got nothing to grow out of.
My feeling is that, this is actually going to link in, it links into that whole question of, selection generally. How do you, what is the best way to select a side? I mean, I still feel that principle of select the best 11 that you are available to you is a sound principle.
Yeah.
I mean, the West Indies desperately need to win test matches. They desperately need to win something. And I just don't think they're in a position where they can gamble on inexperienced players. I mean, Gail, Chanderpaul and Sarwan are not, will not guarantee wins in the series, but I know from an Indian perspective, you see them in the lineup and you're dealing with players of real quality.
And also against an Indian side who aren't bringing their best players to the West Indies. What would actually be most embarrassing for the West Indies is if they got absolutely thrashed by this sort of India B side almost.
Yeah, it's certainly going to be a weakened India side.
And even though there's not necessarily perhaps an opportunity, I think that India will probably win the series quite comfortably. And in fact, we were looking earlier and the West Indies have won one series in the last six years, and that was that freakish series against England 2 years ago, in which they bowled England out for, I think, 46, not very much.
Was it? Yeah,
and then there was the abandoned test as well, and England were one wicket away in two successive matches to the end of the series.
I mean, on the subject of England, I mean, they will be watching this with real interest. I mean, what would they be focusing on in that Indian side?
Well, we've talked in the past about the way that actually we've talked about the West Indians being in transition, but we've talked about the Indians being in transition as well, and a lot of, particularly in the bowling, Zaya Khan is a great bowler, always will be, but people like Patel, who need to prove themselves. I just think that England are going to be on the lookout for some kind of weak link within these elements of the Indian side. Because is there really a weak link in the sort of Tendulkar end of things?
Well, exactly. The bowling lineup, I mean, I've always felt without Zaheer, and Zaheer isn't going to the West Indies, he's not playing there. Without him, Will the Indians struggle to take wickets? And it'll be interesting for them to look at that bowling lineup without him. I mean, I've sort of thought that India's struggles against the short ball have often been, that's been seen as the way to get at the Indian batting lineup. And England, with all that height,
Trumnet-Finn board.
It perhaps will come down to the West Indies board of, well, they've come under fire for a lot of things, but one thing they've come under fire for recently is producing pitches that simply don't suit the home side. I mean, if India find themselves playing on very spin-friendly pitches, then the West Indian board have got yet another case to answer for. If they've got any sense, they'll produce some pitches with life and allow Kemar, Roach and co. to actually have a real go at this lineup.
But do you think, I mean, we've seen in the one days the West Indies winning the last two.
Yeah.
And being competitive in most of the other 2020.
Yeah, they had a real chance, actually, to do something more in this series.
But do you, can you see, and you are the eternal West Indies optimist, dreamer, everything else.
West Indies romantic.
Do you really see any chance for the Windies in a series? Is this where they're going to break that up?
As I said, I've regularly been undone by my desire to predict West Indian victories. In this case, I think it'll be a closer series than maybe anticipated, but I think it'll still be very comfortable for India.
And who will be the key man if the Windies are to win it?
Well, I mean, I'm certainly very interested. I mean, I think they've got to make runs. I mean, that's statingly bleedingly obvious. We are going to be getting pitches if general West Indian experience of the last few years is to be sort of to predict this series. They'll be fairly batting friendly, and the West Indian batting line will need to put a lot of runs on the board. The player I'm most interested in is young leg spinner Devendra Bishu. Made a very exciting entrance into the World Cup.
Yeah.
Very attacking spinner, creates something every time he sort of comes onto bowl. Big challenge against India. You know, obviously very comfortable playing spin.
Yeah, exactly.
But I mean, it's a serious test for him, but he will certainly need to do something. If they're to have any chance.
And similarly, there are players like that on the Indian side who have got who are full of talent and have got slightly got something to prove.
Mm.
Ishan Sharma, who made his debut aged 18 and is now 22 and has played the best part of 35 tests or something like that. And of late hasn't been impressing as much as he could be. And particularly with, as we talked about, the weakened Indian bowling lineup, there is room there for him to really make his mark on things.
Well, without Zaheer to lead the attack, someone else is going to have to. Mm. And I mean, you know, it sounds a bit harsh to say this, but I mean, the West Indian bats, there has been a proneness to collapsing that will probably give a couple of Indian bowlers a chance to make a name for themselves, make a case for themselves.
Overall, I think this is going to be. I mean, we talk about it as being a preface to the England India series, but I think actually it's going to be a fascinating series in itself.
It's going to be a key series in itself. I mean, I have the feeling again, perhaps this might be West Indian. You know, my desire to be optimistic about the West Indies. I think Otis Gibson and Darren Sammy as a partnership are going to be key for the future of cricket there.
Yeah.
I think you've got a very serious coach in Gibson. I think you've got someone in Sammy who's got the charisma to certainly lift this side. And you kind of feel if they fail in creating some sort of turnaround, the future looks very bleak for the game there.
But if they do pull off a win here, it could be something that kickstarts West Indian.
Even just a test as well. I mean, it sounds depressing, but even if they lose the series but can just win a test match, it'd be a huge, huge result for cricket in the region.
So, from the archives, and as Sri Lanka struggle in the murk of the Rose Bowl, we're going to rewind to their first ever test match. And surprisingly, and this surprised me, you only have to rewind 30 years to get back to
Sri Lanka. It's odd, isn't it? And it's a compliment to the country that they really are sort of established members of the test family.
They are, I mean, we're
going back only to 1982 that they played their first test, but it really... You know, you don't see them as latecomers.
No, you don't. And actually, was it 1982 or was it 1981?
It was 1982.
It was 1982. Okay, I'm not going to try and
February 1982.
But there was. It's interesting. You're saying that we've thought of them as being members of sort of the cricketing family, as it were, for a lot longer. And there's a historical reason for that, which is that teams going to and from the subcontinent and Australia would generally stop off at Sri Lanka and play games there. So even though they only became a test side in the 1980s, they'd had first-class status and they'd been playing first-class games for a long, long time before that. And as Ceylon, they had been playing first-class cricket since the 1920s.
Right, so the history was there, even if the test status certainly wasn't.
Exactly. And it's interesting when you think that it was in... I mean, the other sort of great independence story, almost, of the 20th century is Pakistan, who had actually made their test debut some 30 years before in 1952.
Do you think there was a... I mean, Sri Lanka, this is a case where they really should have been given entry a lot earlier.
Oh, absolutely. And they became a... they made their one-day... international debut in 1975, but they certainly had, I mean, the quality of their their domestic setup was almost as sort of as good as anyone. And I suppose it was just a little bit of a mark of the ICC as was, when it still used to stand for the Imperial Cricket Council as opposed to the International Cricket Council. The kind of closed circle that they promoted.
I mean, it's relevant.
Then.
I mean, we don't want to. This is a tangent we don't want to go off on, but relevant at a time when, you know, Ireland are looking for entry. This whole issue of how much we keep Test cricket a closed group. It does appear in this case that it was, you know, almost unfriendly. You know, unfriendly towards the idea of a new
and once Sri Lanka had, Ceylon had become Sri Lanka in 1972, and actually being made into a Test cricket nation in the early 80s actually very much helped them sort of solidify their national identity when that was very young. And actually, when you think that they were winning the World Cup just 15 years after becoming full Test side, I mean, can you imagine? Bangladesh.
Well, I at some point in this, we're going to have to get to Bangladesh. Maybe we'll leave that for a moment. The Bangladesh Sri Lanka.
But anyway, we have set the scene.
The other thing is, it's a great game. This Sri Lanka win the toss. They decide to have a bat, and they're soon in trouble at 34 for 4. They appear to be struggling. The new boys. Botham and Willis have taken a couple of wickets apiece, and the Sri Lankans really seem to be struggling with the pace. Of that England attack. And at that point, Madigali and Ranatunga rebuild. Interesting that you mentioned the World Cup victory. I mean, you've got the young Ranatunga here.
Exactly. These are two really significant people for Sri Lankan cricket. Ranatunga, because he goes on to... I mean, he's a schoolboy at the time, isn't he? Mm.
Yeah, 18 years of age.
18 years of age and kind of dashing batsman. And then Madigali, who's one of the most respected umpires on the circuit, of all the referees now on the circuit.
And they both make half centuries, very different in nature. Ranatunga are much sort of pacer innings. Madigali hangs around. And they sort of repaired the Sri Lankan innings until Derek Underwood gets involved on a turning pitch, and he takes 5 for 28, and, well, the turnaround is sort of wrecked pretty promptly, and Sri Lanka find themselves all out for 218. And, you know, for a new Test side, that's probably relatively par for the course, I assume. But England really don't take advantage of this. They make very heavy work of their reply. Sri Lanka's quit fastest bowler was a computer programmer, Demel. You know, we're dealing in the era of, we've got amateurs involved here. And he picks up Cook, Tavar and Gooch all cheaply, and England find themselves 40 for 3.
It's basically the same situation as the Sri Lankans.
Yeah, very comparable, exactly. It's only really David Gower who does anything of substance for England. He makes a composed 89. And in the end, England only put together 223, a princely 5-run lead at the end of that.
It's fascinating in that, because you have David Gower for England and then Ranatunga for Sri Lanka, in many ways very, very similar batsmen. There must have been a beautiful game
players.
To play.
And Gower, a player who at that stage, you know, had several good contributions in India, a player who was showing himself very adept in those conditions, subcontinent conditions. Sri Lanka appear to be quick learners. I mean, they make a very strong, much, much stronger start in their second innings, and they build to 167 for 3. At this point, you know, a lead of 170-odd, 7 wickets on hand, we know this pitch is going to turn on the final days. Really, it's looking very difficult for England against the new side. And then on the start of the fourth morning, it all goes sort of dismally wrong.
That turn that everyone thinks is going to help Sri Lanka ends up coming out of...
Well, it helps England incredibly dramatically. 7 wickets go down for just 8 runs. I mean, this is a collapse of epic proportions. Yep. And it's England spinners who do the damage. Embry and Underwood. Embry in particular finishes with 6 for 33. But while they bowl well, I think there's a sense that panic sets in. And perhaps to some degree understandable panic. You know, we've got 11 Test debutants. Let's not forget.
And actually the amount that this... I was reading earlier quite a lot of the press that had gone on, and you read the articles in the Sri Lankan national paper, and they were doing things. After the first innings, the first person to have got hit on the chest, the first Sri Lankan batsman to have got hit on the chest while batting for Sri Lanka, was given a medal. In all seriousness, was given a medal saying,
yeah,
you are the first Sri Lankan batsman to have been hit in the chest.
Well, I mean, you made the point.
The whole thing was hyped up to amazing pride.
Yeah, I mean, they were under a huge amount of pressure, and it was obviously a very disappointing collapse, but still, England were left needing to chase 171, which wasn't a formality, especially when Jeff Cook fell without scoring.
Yep.
But England, in the end, get there fairly comfortably. Chris Davar makes a very important 85, and Gower guides the side home with an unbeaten 42. But the 7-wicket defeat simply doesn't reflect a contest that England actually looked to be in real trouble at one stage. And, you know, we were talking before going on air about sort of other test sides making their debuts, and the Sri Lankans really had done far better. I mean, they'd had a very respectable England side on the ropes here, you know.
But also, more generally, it wasn't just in that game, it was in it was over time. And when we did, because a while ago we did the first game that New Zealand ever played.
Yes, yeah.
And I can't, and I should check this before I say it, but I think I'm right in saying that New Zealand didn't win a test until they'd played 32 tests.
I think it was. I'm not even sure if it wasn't more than that. It was certainly a dismal run.
But it's kind of a completely different attitude. Whereas New Zealand were sort of put in, and they made their test debut in 1959, I think.
I'm not going to correct you on
and,
that.
And they were, although I probably should be, probably, but I think it was 59. And they were sort of put in, and the argument then was, they're not very good, but put them in and they can grow. Whereas
yeah,
the argument now seems to be that you need to have reached the level already, and you should be able
well,
to compete
we
by the time
mention,
you go in.
We were going to mention Bangladesh at some point. I mean, they, if you compare them with the Sri Lankan side, were clearly woefully underprepared. And you know, there's something very impressive about the fact that it did take Sri Lanka a while to get up to speed. You know, we've talked about the fact there were amateurs in this side, but it's incredibly impressive that even if you take into account the fact that it was home conditions, you throw them into their first test match against an England side full of talent and experience, they make a real contest of it. Had they made 100 more runs in their first innings, they could well
Anything
have won the
happened.
Game. They could well have won the match. To the book review, which is in fact this week a film review, and it's very rare that you sort of see cricket making much of an impact sort of in, you know, at the box office, I suppose, in the world of cinema. But Fire in Babylon has certainly been dominating kind of film review pages, been getting an awful lot of positive attention, which is interesting really, because it seems very much quite a sort of esoteric cricketing story, you know, the rise of a West Indian team of the 70s and 80s. It's been odd that it's been making a splash kind of beyond.
But it's a very, at the same time, it's a very powerful story. I went to watch it in a fairly small cinema in Cambridge. I don't think I've ever seen such a great gender imbalance in a cinema. I think there was one lady and out of an audience of some 60 or 70.
How old was she, as a matter of interest?
Oh, she was young. She was part of our group.
Oh,
no,
really?
She wasn't part of our group. I was trying to think who I went with. No, she wasn't part
it's
of our
It's a random
group.
Girl who Toby picked up on the way to
well,
cinema.
Well, exactly. I do like to spread the word. But what was interesting is the way that you could hear, and seeing it at a cinema is definitely the way to do it.
Mm.
But you see, and they have quite a lot of good clips of some of the balls bowled, some of the moments when people were being struck in various unfortunate parts of the body, and you could feel the entire place collectively wince as this happened. There is something very compelling about that part of it, but also about this kind of narrative of I mean, it's almost like that film whose name I've completely forgotten about the bobsleigh team.
Ah, Cool
it's got,
Running.
But you are
comparing the rise of West Indian cricket and West Indian nationalism to
now,
a comedy
where, this
Disney film.
Taken, this is
what
I'm being taken
Jamaican
out of context.
Film.
But there is something. There was something kind of slightly. Feel good is the wrong
right,
word.
Okay,
but
it's an underdog story.
It's an underdog story, isn't it?
I mean, what's interesting, we're going to certainly talk about the fact that the film takes distinct liberties with history, but the film is set up by the 1975 West Indies tour to Australia, where Lillian Thompson treat the batsman with brutality, yeah. but perhaps more than that, the Australian crowds treat the entire team with brutality. I mean, for me,
and
the most poignant moment...
Well.
Oh, well, huge racism. The most poignant moment of the film for me came in the footage of that, when Michael Holding yeah. goes to Clive Lloyd in tears, and apparently, we hear from the interviews, simply says that he didn't think cricket yeah. could be played yeah. like that. Yeah. The sheer hardness and brutality of the game, the way it was played in Australia at the time... And the West Indies get hammered 5-1. Suddenly, the whole film is about how do they respond to that? How to respond to that, the way they were treated?
And that is one of the... I mean, the timeline of the film is, as you've mentioned, slightly skewed.
You've made good... But, I mean, the people who are missed out in particular...
Well, you would get the impression from watching the film that suddenly... you know, Gary Sabres woke up one morning and thought, ha-ha, cricket, that's quite a good way of asserting West Indian kind of national identity.
Yeah.
Whereas, in fact, what had been happening since the 30s, probably before the 30s, actually, from the 20s, is people like Leary Constantine, C.L.R. James, most famously, had been developing these ideas of nationalism and cricket together. And that was one of the things that was slightly... in a sense, disappointing about the film. But having said that, I mean, it's been a box office hit, and how much of a box office hit would it have been if it had
right.
been discussing the Marxist writings of C.L.R. James?
And you accept the fact that whereas a book can maybe aim to be comprehensive, films do tend to have to make decisions, have to make choices. I mean, the political nature of the film is interesting because I found myself inspired by it, in a sense, but also quite uncomfortable about it because I yeah. felt, well, do I want cricket to be a vehicle for politics necessarily? I mean, particularly there were moments when you had supporters of the team talking about how it got the West Indies sort of up on its feet as a region, yeah. and you yeah. thought, well, are we exaggerating? And also, more importantly, I mean, do we celebrate the fact that cricket plays this role, or do we get concerned about cricket being linked into nationalism? I'm not sure.
Well, certainly it did seem to sort of depict everything as being a little bit hunky-dory. It didn't help when you had the images of, I can't remember who it was, a kind of... Viv Richards equivalent playing cricket on the beach with all the young boys in the sun.
That was a little bit silly, wasn't it? I meant to ask you, what did you make of the musical interludes? Did you enjoy those?
I did, actually. I thought
really, I'm surprised.
So for people who haven't seen the film, they obviously commissioned musical...
A host of the real A-list musicians.
Related to cricket. Are they? I mean, I'd never heard of any of them.
I mean, I'm assuming that they are.
Oh right, okay. I wasn't just missing out. I would have missed out anyway. But I thought that was quite a nice kind of patchwork because what I think the film did quite successfully convey was the way in which and I've never been to the Caribbean and I only speak from sort of secondhand experience from having read quite a lot about West Indian cricket and West Indian culture but the way that cricket does absolutely permeate West Indian culture.
Yeah.
Which in a sense makes it kind of inevitable as a political vehicle, I suppose.
And I mean, ultimately there was a sense that this was, and I can't remember what a historian at some point in the film puts it in a way that, you know, this was an area that was viewed as third world, that was viewed as incapable of producing anything world class, and yep. suddenly they produced a test team that couldn't lose. On going back to much more pure cricketing stuff, I actually have to say, I found the footage of the fast bowling, of the sort of brutality of it, a little bit uncomfortable, actually. And I felt
yeah.
that, actually, I mean, I often get tired with cricket traditionalists, I really do. But I actually found myself siding with the traditionalists on this. I don't think that brutality was what I'm comfortable describing as
well,
good cricket.
There's also that interesting dynamic that you've said about when they were in Australia... In that first tour that Sparks were off in 75, the West Indies were there saying we didn't know cricket could be played like this, we didn't know that this was cricket, mm. but actually that they decided to fight fire with fire, and five years later that's what they had done. And you do, there is always this question, which I wonder whether the filmmakers sort of let deliberately hang in the air a little bit, of whether actually the team lowered itself rather than raised itself to
Yeah, the Australians, I think a lot of the West Indians made a very fair point that a lot of the criticism came from jealousy. It came from the fact that simply no other team could find four fast bowlers bowling.
And if people could have found those,
if they could have, they would have. But I had to say, watching it, I thought, well, there is something compelling about watching bowlers bowling that way. But actually, there was something unpleasant about it. And it's interesting that, you know, we're looking at it 20 and some, you know, 30 years on, and there's still something unpleasant about it. I mean, one thing, the film doesn't make the point, you know, it's not the job of the film to make this point, but as a modern cricket fan, you can't help making the comparisons with the side of today, especially all this talk of calypso cricket, this idea of West Indian cricketers as entertainers without a backbone. I mean, what do you think, you know, how could you make the connections with the side of today?
So that was the criticism, and as the film would have it, although I'm not entirely sure how true it is, one of the motivations behind the kind of great cricketing, Windies cricketing dynasty that occurred in the 70s and 80s, was that the world wrote them off as calypso cricketers before then, people who could play on the beach and they could play nice sort of silky cover drives. And
without winning games.
But when the going got really tough and people were bowling 90 mile an hour bounces to their head and they needed to keep it out in order to win a game,
they
weren't able to do that. So, I mean, I'm not entirely sure how true that actually is. And actually, I think, I mean, again, this issue of the timeline not being quite right. We have, on this podcast, we reviewed the wonderful book King Cricket by Gary Sobers, which talks about the 66 series when the West Indies came and won in England, which was the seminal series, whereas in this film, for the sake of their narrative, which starts in 75,
the series
with the Australian series,
they
don't mention it, and they actually build up the 78 series when the Windies comes to England as being the big seminal one, whereas in fact there would have been a bigger sea change.
The interesting thing is that when this film was released, not surprisingly, all those great figures involved were repeatedly interviewed, this sort of thing, and a lot of comments were made about how miserable the state of the current side is. Yep. And you wonder for the current side, you know, what inspiration they can take from it. And you particularly this idea of, you know, focus on winning the game. This idea that entertainment simply isn't enough, that what Clive Lloyd brought to the side was an ethic of just winning games, more than anything else, more than entertainment or the spirit of cricket.
But also, at the same time, one of the things that comes out of the film is the fact that that team, the political, the social situations which gave rise to that team, but also the sort of individual geniuses within the team, were very much a one-off.
Yeah.
And that West Indies cricket rose to greatness because of one-off situations. They didn't rise to greatness because they created a wonderful domestic setup, which then, because I mean, can you imagine how interesting that film would have been if it was? And so the administrators decided to make a wonderful county game in which, and that's how they became great. It's not about that. It's about the way in which, out of nowhere, suddenly there was a spark.
A triumph of sort of circumstance, really. I mean, one thing that was fascinating looking at the tests in England was how there was this incredible immigrant fan base in England, which, you know, for various reasons, just doesn't really happen anymore in England. I mean, many of those families that at that time identified with the West Indies, now, you know, they're generations on in England. They don't, and it was actually a rather wonderful thing, I think, to see a ground like Lord's the Oval filled with West Indian fans who were at the same time sort of home fans. I think that was fantastic.
And that tradition as well of West Indian players coming over to play in particularly the Lancashire League, which happened a lot in the 50s and earlier, which has seemed to have largely died out.
But it's certainly, I mean, it's a fascinating film, and I think for anyone who's interested in cricket, it instinctively makes compelling viewing.
And anyone who isn't interested in cricket probably isn't listening to this.
No, probably isn't listening to this, but I would suggest maybe the film does have an appeal beyond, you know, does have an appeal beyond your average cricket nerd.
Yeah. So, to the blogs, and this week we're looking at the Nightwatch Girl, who describes herself as the non-expert expert's guide to the greatest game of all. It's a cricket blog for the uninitiated, which initially made me slightly sceptical about the whole episode, but having said that, before you interrupt, having said that, what is actually quite fascinating about this is that sometimes blogs fall into a rut, but there are some interesting perspectives that are
I mean, I suppose what makes this blog interesting is the fact that I suppose most people start blogs out of a kind of sort of a slightly arrogant view of I've got something to say that is better than everyone else is because I know more about cricket than everyone else. And I mean, this blog takes a sort of very different attitude of clearly a fan of the game who, you know, isn't sort of competing in the expert stage.
You won't get many stats, and you won't find out about what's happened that day.
But I mean, we've chatted before in this part of the podcast about kind of what blogs can do that journalism can't. And I mean, what this blog goes for is sort of quick posts with sort of generally quite a funny perspective. And you get quite a lot of sort of a lot of value within quite very short posts.
You do. There's an interesting post entitled "What Happens to Cricketers When They're Not Cricketers Anymore," where she makes the I mean, there's a case study of Andrew Flintoff who starts off step one, Morrison's advert showing acting versatility was just a hint of desperation. Step two, get your own TV show. Step three, after dinner speeches. And step four, threatened to turn out for your local's brother's local team in Lancashire, and then moves on to Ricky Ponting, for whom steps 1, 2, 3, and 4 are all rather TBC. but there is, as you say, rather a kind of refreshing lack of sort of being tied down to that.
And I think the point is, you know, we talk, and I mean, the reason we have this section, I suppose, in the podcast is that there is, the cricketing blogosphere is very interesting. You know, it's a very healthy array of different views, and this is a sort of blog that does something different. And I think too often, you know, cricket can come across as very unfriendly towards people. They read articles or they read blog posts on it that are just inaccessible. And, you know, although I suppose we can be as sort of try-hard pretentious as anyone, you know, there's something quite fun about a blog that also quite enjoys... Speak for myself. Yeah, that enjoys sort of the slightly gossipy side of it, you know, that argues that Kevin Peterson could probably be dropped purely for not having red hair anymore, or that slightly bizarre badger Mahikad, or, you know, the same blog that, you know, that laments the fact that Stuart Broad both isn't very English or perhaps is too English, you know, whatever it is that isn't quite right
whatever
about
it
him.
Whatever it is that means.
But, you know, some slightly sort of random observations, and I think it's the idea that, you know, cricket writing can sort of be fun and doesn't necessarily need to be focused on sort of the heavy hitting issues of the game the entire time.
So it's definitely worth a browse. Having said that, last updated Monday the 6th of June, and here we are on the 17th. That's probably reverse swept radio frequency, which isn't doing very well ourselves.
That's true, actually. But yeah, www.nightwatchgirl.com. And I mean, of interest to everyone, but perhaps of interest particularly to those who are kind of making their way into the complex and, you know, forbidding world of cricket. And finally, to the debate, and this week we're going to be looking at the whole issue of selection, prompted by Simon Cattish's fairly extraordinary outburst, taking on, well, the entire Australian selection committee. I mean, the quote that sort of stuck out here was the you pay peanuts, you get monkeys. That's certainly the one that's been sort of dominating the media agenda here.
And it seems to come kind of out of nowhere. I certainly didn't realise that. Well, I realise that Australian selection has been dodgy, if not woeful, for a long while. But the thing that Cattish was pointing towards, which is a kind of systemic failure in Australian selection, was something that was fairly new.
Well, I mean, he was obviously furious at what seems to be the premature end of his Test career, his international career. And interestingly, he's been backed up by Ricky Ponting on this, who just seems to feel that the entire selection operation there is pretty amateur. Mm. I mean, the topic we're really settling on is that, you know, the cricket has moved on and the selectors have been left behind. It's obvious that on talking about this issue, you've got to make international comparisons, haven't you? We've got the different nations doing their own thing. What's interesting is that in terms of the setup, England and Australia do fairly similar things. They don't go for all-out full-time selectors. England have got Jeff Miller as the national selector, who is full-time, earning
but only since recently.
Right, exactly. Only since the Schofield report into the 2007 yep. Ashes. Ashley Giles and Whittaker, his assistants, his fellow selectors, are both part-time. Australia similarly has got a model where Glenn Chappell is full-time. The rather curiously named national talent manager, that's yep. Glenn Chappell's yep. role. And his three fellow selectors are all part-time, including chairman Andrew Hilditch. The point is that Katic's feeling that you pay for the best results, you know, doesn't necessarily seem to be...
No, it doesn't seem to sort of hit the nail on the head. There are two strands I think we might draw out. One of which is the issue of central contracts, or as they're called in England, or whatever the equivalent is in Australia.
But they have a very similar
setup in Australia. And the second issue is actually... Exactly as you say, whether it is the issue of whether you have full-time selectors, or whether it's actually a wider issue, about attitudes to the game.
In recent years, the England selectors, who traditionally got a huge amount of flak, it's actually been fascinating. In recent years, the press have had very little to call the England selectors up about. They've really yep. done a very effective job.
They have, and what the England selectors have done very well is to use central contracts to show loyalty in players, and to sort of develop players over a period of time.
Loyalty has really been the key part of the England philosophy. They have stuck by players repeatedly. I mean, the most successful case of recent times probably being Alistair Cook.
Yep, exactly.
I mean, there was a huge media call to get rid of him from the side. And, I mean, obviously, the results there have been extraordinary.
It seems that the problem with the Australian side is that or the problem that Katic is pointing to is the fact that as soon as you have some kind of central contract system, it makes everything black and white. And that as soon as you say to Simon Katic, you've no longer got a central contract, that kind of terminates his career automatically.
Yeah.
And it doesn't allow for the kind of flexibility of saying, you know, at the moment you're not who we're looking for, but in 2 years down the line.
And I mean, if we're saying that it isn't the question of how much you get paid, it's more about what the selectors believe, what their philosophy is. I mean, a lot of the controversy in Australia seems to be about Glenn Chappell's focus on youth and bringing yep. through young players. And that appears to be what's done for Simon Katic here. I mean, it seems astonishing, a player that's had the success he's had, especially in recent years, actually, to say that he's not one of the top 25 quickest.
Well, it's interesting because Australia seems to have this kind of dilemma, which we talked a little bit about earlier in the year, and I have this theory.
Looking forward to it.
That the Australian selectors basically mucked up when they didn't... Well, basically, they didn't handle the transition between the... basically, the war Ponting era and the current era well at all. Because what they did was they basically didn't mesh those two eras together. So, Khawaja only played when Ponting was injured. They will probably never play in the same side together.
Right. And the experience needs to lead youth into the side.
As there has been in India. And that what's actually happening now with Glenn Chappell is trying to, this overemphasis on youth, this overemphasis on suddenly, hang on, we've got a dearth of talent in the side, we need
and
to
it,
get
it
in.
And it comes a little
players.
Bit back to what we were talking about with West Indies, this idea that really, at any one time, I feel a test team needs to pick their best 11. Actually, I think it's something that England have done well recently. You
yep.
know, there hasn't been a need, they haven't looked to over-promote young players, and they have been quite comfortable picking older players.
But then again, I think England have been in a very privileged position where they haven't had to say, oh, look, we need to bring in someone because he'll be the player for 10 years
yeah.
in the future, even though he's not right now, because a lot of the players who are still going to be there in 10 years in the future, the Alistair Cooks of this world, are also the best players at the moment.
It's stating the obvious, but selection is much easier when the team's playing well.
When you've got good players.
And frankly, yeah. that's what's been the story with England, and it's been the issue for Australia. I mean, and I think what it comes down to, I mean, Simon Katic's critique was very much, you're not taking selection seriously, you've got an era where some players are earning millions.
Yep.
And the selectors are still part-time. That just doesn't tally up. But I think, you know, you look at that England-Australia comparison, you realise a lot of this is really about just philosophies. It's not about professionalism. It's not about pay. Well, thank you for putting up with us once more. We'll be back in a couple of weeks' time, by which point, you know, England will have, I don't think they'll probably have finished Lanker off. We'll be getting excited about the England-India series, and hopefully it will have stopped raining.